bless you, Steve.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Appreciate that. Great. So with this week of hope as a context to what we're doing today, look at you up in the gallery as well. I'll try to lift my eyes occasionally. I'd like us to revisit a very, very famous moment in the New Testament, the life of Jesus. And I've loved these, what I often call the Jesus encounters, for many years. And it's shaped a lot of what I live with, and certainly the formation and the energy behind Miracle Street is really so much of it. I just find myself telling these stories of the, not just the one-on-one encounters of Jesus, Bartimaeus, Zacchaeus, thief on the cross, woman in adultery, the list goes on and on and on. And in each one of those, there is this snapshot of the heart and intention of the Father released through Christ. But this is a big event, this one that I want to talk about, a little bit about today. It's the only one of Jesus' miracles that you find recorded in all four of the Gospels, except the resurrection, of course, which does crop up a little bit, although sections of the church wish it didn't, I think. But obviously, you know, that is there, and it's the centerpiece to everything we have built our faith around, the resurrection of Christ. But this one event is portrayed slightly differently in each of the four synoptic Gospels, but clearly it's a special event, and it's clearly something that we are meant to take particular notice of. And it's what we often call the feeding of the 5,000, but I prefer to call it the day on the mountain, because I don't think it was just about the provision of food. I think there is something going on in this story. There is something that Jesus is working into the hearts and lives of his disciples, as well as meeting a need. So there's four kind of words that I want to talk about just for a few moments each. But we'll come on to that in a moment. Let's just read the passage. This is John's account of this incredible story. And this is what it says. John 6, starting from verse 5. When Jesus looked up, he saw a great crowd coming towards him. He said to Philip, "Where should we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked it only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip replied, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish. But how far will that go among so many?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place. And the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He then did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is a prophet who has come into the world." It's as if the tectonic plates of Jesus' love and power start to move simultaneously together, and this incredible moment, this incredible event, takes place on the side of a mountain. I think the guys who supplied the bread on this day possibly were these guys, Jehovah's. What do you reckon? Maybe not. So there's 5 key words that I just want to bring to your attention today. It's not a big kind of Bible study moment. Hopefully it will inspire us. But I do want to say one or two things that delve quite deep into the context of this particular event. It's kind of, for me, like a three-dimensional snapshot of the kingdom of heaven touching the earth. And as we move into hope, and it's so brilliant that Dave Lockyer said that on the video, that, you know, it, in the end, if it's just about clever events and shiny banners and effort, then do you know what? We probably ought to do something else. But if it is possible that we can partner with each other and partner with God, something of this order is possible. Because this, as I say, is it's a snapshot. It's all going on in this passage. And if we can somehow allow this passage and this story to recalibrate our Christianity and touch our hearts, I believe that we could do something wonderful over these next few weeks together. So let's try, if we can, to not just read the text, but let's try and get back 2,000 years and give or take 2,000 miles from where we are sitting today, and just try and get back to this mountain and allow the magnitude of what happened to disturb us, to shake us, to encourage us, to give us faith and vision for this town of Eastleigh and all that we're trying to achieve together. So here are my five words that I want us to look at today. Relevance, compassion, provision, flexibility and training. Five little touchstones, that's all. And as I say, I'm not going to take an hour over each one because I'm sure you've got chicken in the oven. So let's look at the first one. It's so much here about what mission and engagement is all about. There's something about the truth, but there's something about culture and relevance going on here. So relevance, first one. Do you know, on days, I wonder whether ordinary people pick up a Bible if they've got one. I don't know about you. I mean, I didn't grow up in a Christian family. You know, the only big family book we had in our house was Case Catalog. You know, I was not a church kid. Really? No, I wasn't. I was not from a Christian family. But I just think people do read the Bible from time to time. And I just wonder on days when they read about the explosive power that was going on around Jesus and around the early church, and the sense of connectedness, the popularity that was around Jesus. You know, the kids and the sick and the dying and the forgotten. They just wanted to be in his means. They just wanted to be part of the scene, part of the action. Why? Because he was profoundly relevant. Because he knew how to connect. And I wonder if people read these things and then, you know, look at the church and scratch their heads with the measure of disbelief as to how that is ended up with what a lot today is described as normal Christianity. I don't know, but I certainly look at that and making a statement like that, I am very much part of the problem. You know, I'm not standing here as some kind of self-appointed expert, not at all. You know, I know that I've got miles and miles of journey to do to be more relevant than I am to the people that I know that are, you know, not Christians, my friends. So, you know, I often say to people, you know, that you don't need to be boring and predictable to be a Christian, but it really helps. You know, it's really going to help you to connect. So what about this is relevant? How is this an example or an illustration of how Jesus was relevant to the people? Do you know, there are really strong Old Testament overtones to this story. There's an awful lot that we could go into it, but quite simply, Jesus is taking bread in a place that Matthew and Mark both describe as a remote place. And he's taking the bread and he's offering up to heaven and he's breaking it and he's distributing it with limitless resource to the people. And this is a Jewish crowd. This is why people said of Jesus, this is a prophet who's come among us. In other words, he knows our people. He knows our history. He knows where we've come from. He knows our book. He seems to speak with a new authority and with a new power and with a new energy, but it seems to have echoes of what we already understand. And of course, 1500 years earlier, Moses had led the people of Israel out into the wilderness, and God had provided them with bread that seemed to come from nowhere. And so I believe that Jesus had that story in sharp focus as he is connecting with this hungry crowd. He's actually painting a picture as well out there on the side of a mountain. It's breathtaking the way Jesus seemed to orchestrate that event, and he ticked all the boxes at the same time. You know, sometimes we can be funny, powerful, entertaining, but we don't seem to have a lot of substance. Other times we can have all the substance in the world, but it's boring and dull and nobody is able to connect with it. Jesus seemed to marry these two tremendous challenges together of being rooted in the truth, rooted in the substance of what God was all about, but in a way that was electrifying and exciting and dynamic to the people who knew nothing of his message and what he had come to do. One of my great heroes, I read a lot, I'm a massive hero of Billy Graham, massive hero of Billy Graham, that's a pretentious thing to say. Billy Graham is a massive hero of mine. He doesn't know who I am. But another person that I've really read about a lot, and I don't know whether any of you have heard of her, but her name is Amy Semple McPherson. She's the founder of the Four Square denomination in America, and I won't tell you the whole story, but basically as a woman, she travelled as an evangelist with one of the big tents across America, and then she got to Los Angeles and God told her to stay there, and she built this building which is still at the church today. It's called the Angelus Temple. It's owned by the Dream Center in Los Angeles, and she was an actress, she was a dancer, she loved the creative, and she would put on these massive events that she called the Illustrated Sermon, and people would come from some of the roughest, toughest parts of LA just to hear her speak, to watch her. It's interesting how, you know, how people like George Whitfield had this dramatic way of communicating the gospel. He would speak to the queues outside the theatres and playhouses, and then the people would decide not to go into the show because they found him to be more entertaining than the show that they were lined up to go in. Of course, he would get beaten up by the theatre managers because he was taking their train. Incredible stories, and Amy was like one of those people. And this is what she said, it's just a simple sentence. She said this: we must be faithful to the word and faithful to the moment. It's powerful, isn't it? It's the same thing again. It is the old story, the big story of God, but it is mixed with enough contemporary communication and understanding in order to connect with a vast group of people. The first one is relevance. The second one is compassion. It's like Jesus positions his disciples in front of this vast crowd before asking in this question: where are we going to get bread for these people? Now, I don't know what you think, but if I'd have been one of those disciples, I would have been freaked out by this. I mean, they have been led up a mountain, and they have turned round to look at the path that they've just walked, and they see this vast crowd coming towards them. Now, we know that there were more than 5,000, because they only counted the fellas. You know, so maybe there were 9,000 or 10 or even 12,000, who knows? But this is a very, very large crowd of people. This is like a marauding sort of Manchester United, you know, mob on their way to Wembley. You know, these are hungry, and if you know there's 5,000 guys among them, you know, anybody who's married to a guy will know that a hungry man is something that you need to deal with quite quickly. So Jesus is looking at this crowd, and he's looking at his disciples, and he's speaking to them about compassion. But it's interesting because 30 verses later, Jesus describes himself as the bread of life. So it's not flour and water we're talking about here. Jesus is actually looking at the deep, profound need in the hearts of these people. Yeah, I mean, he's going to feed them, clearly they're hungry. But he's using this illustration as the bread to work something into the hearts of his disciples at the same time. How are we going to feed these people? What are we going to give to these people? And I think sometimes God is asking us to look at Eastleigh, and he's asking us the question: what are we going to do for these people? What are we going to do for them? Just serve them up a diet that we ourselves have week after week? Or are we going to pay a price? And it's not to say that we're going to throw out everything that we do, because it's not bad, but it's just stuff. It's just what we do. It's what we like to do. And it's sometimes, maybe more seriously, it's what we insist upon. But if we are going to be truly relevant, we've got to have compassion for the people that we're going to be coming across every day of the week, not just in Hope, but the people that some of you interact with socially and at work and in the roads and your family. Do we really care or not? Because if we don't care, if we don't have compassion, we may as well sell up this family business that we call the church and do something else with our time and money. So compassion is where it starts and ends every time. Strategy is important, but you know what? It's worth 50p a bucket in the end. If we don't care, if we're not driven with that heart desire to make Jesus that we have known to other people, we're in a problem. So Jesus is addressing the deep need here for spiritual answers to spiritual questions. It's not just about the all-you-can-eat buffet that is about to be served up. for these guys. He's actually using it to press for a deeper response. I believe that the church should be the place where people gravitate towards. You know, certainly if you wind the clock back 300 years, churches were the centre of the community. They really were. I work a lot in Cornwall. I work with the Methodist churches and Free Methodists as well. And a lot of these kind of Wesleyan chapels. I mean, I've been to some big ones. You know, there's a place called St. Just, which is sort of Penzance and some. You know, it's almost sort of the end of the world. They call it the end of the world, actually. You live there. And there's a 700-seater Methodist chapel there in a town that's in a village of about 800 people there. So you go into it, you think, this is nonsensical. I mean, who on earth would build a building of this size in a place like this? And of course, it speaks of a bygone era. It speaks of a time when people travelled distances to get to church because they wanted to be part of what was going on. And I think once again, you know, our church is not the buildings, of course, it's our homes, it's our relational networks, but we must be the people who provide answers and hope and purpose. We must be those people, not in our own strength, of course. But we've got to care. Number three, we're doing well. Still with me. Number three is provision. This is a stunning example of how we can meet a very big need with very meagre resources. Do you ever feel like you have nothing to offer? Do you ever listen to, you know, information about projects and plans and you just go, I haven't got a lot in the tank right now. There's a lot going on in my life. Here you've got an example. A profound need being met with a kid's packed lunch. That's all they've got to work with. And not just that, they're exposed on the side of a mountain. And if they don't come up with some kind of plan here, some sort of solution, you know, they've got a problem on their hands, I would suggest. Because this is a big crowd that have come for a very specific purpose. And the disciples are looking at Jesus, and I love the way, you know, Jesus asks the question, and then he says in John, you know, that he already had in mind what he was going to do. He said it to test them. Well, thanks for the test, but possibly not quite in this environment would be brilliant. Jesus already knew what he was going to do. And so he takes them onto a mountain. Why? Because the power of God belongs in the offices and the hospitals and the schools and the supermarkets. It doesn't just belong in the environments where we feel at home. And in fact, very, very few of the encounters around Jesus happened in any kind of religious context at all. Up a mountain, in somebody's house, on the street. So much of what Jesus did was in a very secular environment. I heard someone say a while ago, 96% of what Jesus did was outdoors. 96% of the church is indoors. Now that's not common about buildings, because of course there's been a cultural shift in that time. But something has got to flow out of the doors and the windows of our buildings and touch the street as well. Something I feel is out there for us in the fresh air of risk. You know, we've got to push way beyond our comfort zones. And for us, you know, some of those comfort zones are different to other people. You know, I preach the gospel a lot outdoors and sometimes in some hostile environments. I've had the legitimacy of my birth questioned on numerous occasions. and we went right across southern Spain 2 years ago with a big truck that we call the Main Stage. And you know, and some people say to me, oh, you know, southern Spain, lovely, Fuengirola, Marbella. I think, no, you go 50 miles inland of the south coast of Spain. It's a very, very different world, and it's super tough. Lots of Chinese gangs operating and drugs and stuff like that. And you know, and I've seen something in the fresh air of risk, you know, just doing something and being prepared every day to kind of cross the chicken line, you know, into a new place. And some people say to me, gosh, I could never do what you do. And it's like, but I have to be quite careful because there's an integrity check for me in that, because I've been doing this for a long time, 28 years I've been doing this. And there are things which look high risk to some people are actually quite easy for me because I've done it a lot and I've got a team and I've got, you know, sort of ex kind of prisoners now part of my team who will look after me if necessary. You know, so it's not all as risky as it looks. So I think for all of us, you know, we've got to be able to push beyond our own personal comfort zones. And that may be talking to the next door neighbour that you've known for 15 years and just having a conversation with them and saying, look, I just wonder if you kind of know what I do on Sunday. Well, this is what I do and this is why I do it. You know, that's a powerful, powerful step of faith for some of us. But for all of us, we have to push beyond. And here we have a picture of how Jesus met the need with meagre resources. And he did it because he was present in the situation. That's why it was possible. Because Jesus was there. I had an amazing story. I know it's true because I trust the source. And it happened in Romsey. And there was this lady who was a single mum. She had three kids. And not a lot of money. But she prayed and she believed God. And she found God say to her, go to the supermarket and load the trolley. She's got no credit and she's not got much cash, so she goes to the supermarket and she's got her three kids in tow and she starts to fill the trolley with budget range food and she feels that God says to her, no, the best. So she unloads all that stuff and she puts fine cuts of meat and Tesco Finest, I don't know what supermarket it was, but she puts all the best stuff in there and she heads towards the till, believing that God has spoken to her. She's got her three kids and she's on her own. And she starts to load everything onto the checkout, not a difficult word to remember. And it all gets rung through and it comes to the end and the lady says £160, whatever it was. And she's just about to say the only thing that she can say, which is, I don't have any means to pay for this. And the checkout goes off. There's like an electrical failure, not just in that till, but five or six. There's a whole bank of tills that's gone out. So she's now standing there and a supervisor comes up and says, I'm so sorry, you know, we need to load the stuff back into your trolley, we need to do something else. She starts to do that, she feels God speaks to her again. And she feels what the Lord says to her is, stay where you are. 40 minutes later, she's now looking foolish, standing in an aisle that has no people and no checkout system and no lights on with her children. 40 minutes later, somebody comes, a new sister, the thing's fixed, and she says, sorry, got to bring it all through again. Yeah, that's fine. She runs all through it, £160, same amount. She's just about to say her kind of rehearsed line, I'm sorry, I don't have anything in the way of paying for this. And the intercom cuts in from customer services, and the voice says, the lady at checkout 14, you are our millionth customer, everything you bought is in the store. True story. This is a picture of what is possible if we choose to live in the danger zone, whatever that means to each one of us. Provision. Number four, flexibility. Nothing that God does is random. I believe that. But it does seem that Jesus has an ability to think on his feet. He's incredibly adaptable. He seems to be able to set this thing up just in response to the need. And many other situations when Jesus is in a conversation and there's some kind of curveball that comes in, whether it's, you know, the woman at the well in John 4 and she seems to throw this kind of red herring into the conversation in response to the statement, go and get your husband. Oh, I haven't got a husband. Yes, you have. You have to. She's been around the block a few times and there's a bit of story. Jesus seems to be able to live in that spontaneous moment, even though he is living out the pattern of his father. It's a mystery. And similarly, I think flexibility for us is really important, both in terms of the projects that we engage in and the way that we live personally and work out the gospel in our own lives. This is brilliant in this story. Get the people to sit down. That's what Jesus says. Get the people to sit down. Because there was plenty of grass in that place. Yeah, right. I've spent half of my life in outdoor events. I'll tell you, not that simple. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,000 people. Get the people to sit down. Grass and space is not the problem here. The problem is the absence of a zoning system, megaphones, cattle prods, high visibility workwear, risk assessments, liability insurance up to £10 million. That's what's needed here. Not grass or space or someone going, could we sit down? Row F3, can we sit down? I mean, it's laughable. It's a joke. It's a joke. Get the people to sit down. Thousands and thousands of people, as far as the eye can see. 12 guys who were already shell-shocked by the presence of these people in the first place. It's absolutely amazing. But yet again, Jesus didn't follow the script. He didn't do what he probably should have done, which was to keep it all contained in the temple, everyone in rows. But he just didn't do it that way. He did it differently. And that's what got him into so much trouble with the Pharisees. It wasn't just the things that he said, but the fact that he dared to tamper with their system. He did it a different way. So many people think that Jesus came to start religion. Jesus came to end religion. Some of the harshest words that Jesus spoke were reserved for religious people. You slam the door of heaven in men's faces. You don't go in yourself. You stop everyone else going. Or there's this one. Whitewashed sepulchres. Well, that sounds lovely. Or quite poetic, in fact. It just basically means you look good on the outside. You've been power washed on the outside. But inside you stink of death. That's what he's saying. This is the religious elite. These are the people that people bow down to in the street. No wonder he ended up on a cross. Quite apart from the story that he was living out. Jesus was a man born to die. The shadow of the cross was being cast on the street wherever he went. Of course, the cross was coming. But in the way that it worked out, pragmatically, in that culture at that time, Jesus was heading for trouble. Doing what he did, saying what he did, and the way that he said it, and the people that he mixed with. But he was fiercely courageous, and he refused to bow to a disgraceful system that made victims out of the forgotten and the marginalised. Not interested. And that's why he seemed to hunt out the poor and the sick and the dying. Not because God doesn't love the rich, but there was a statement that was being made because he was bringing down the religious system that was sexist, racist, misogynist. Something of a spirit of ethnic cleansing was already in it. And when you look at history and how it all played out, who knows where the links are. But there was something in that system at that time which was appalling that Jesus was after. And the final thing in my little list here is what I've called training. Jesus utilised this model of hands-on training, didn't he? You know, that's why, a great passion and emphasis for me over these years is to get right into the heart and the inner workings of church, because I think that's where change can happen. Because I think we've got to model something. It's not about an evangelist rocking up and saying, you know what, I've got a hot talk, and you really need to bring your friends to listen to me, because I'm that good, and I'm really going to nail it, so, you know, bring your friends. I don't know what you feel about that. I see a lot of that around. But I think a better way is the way Jesus did it. And he got them right at close quarters and he said, you know what, you can do this as well. I'm not opposed to Bible college or anything like Bible college, except when it churns out layers and layers of academics that know everything about the book and nothing about the author. Then we have a problem. And so Jesus operated with a different model. And, you know, this was his plan, okay? This was his three sort of semester plan. And the first bit was, I'll do it and you watch. Okay, that's module number one. Module number two is, you do it and I'll watch. And the final module number three, is you do it and I'm going. 3 years. That's it. And somehow, and that's why you see, you know, the disciples crashed out in a rented room in that awful period between the Ascension and Pentecost. And they're holding on to a word. Because Jesus said, the power's coming. But then he also said, it's not for you to know the times or the days. Which is slightly ambiguous, to say the least. Because they've been through this crash course for 3 years where they've seen these mind-bending miracles on the street. They've seen the dead raised and the sick healed and the lonely loved. And now it's fallen full square in their laps. And they've got to leave this thing. But that was the way Jesus did it. It's something in the adventure of being on mission together where the superstars start to get noticed and they are not the people that everyone thought they probably would be. It's a whole load of other people. I met a lady 3 years ago, something like that, in her 90s. Never in her life spoken through a microphone. But she was one of the most powerful evangelists I've ever met. Because she had led literally hundreds of people to Christ. And she was active in her nursing home where she lived just before she died. Highly impressive individual. But never did it in the way that most people would describe an evangelist. It's amazing how Jesus works the principles of the kingdom into the very hearts of his working class men. We have to be really careful that we're not so learned and studied that we've got all the answers to all the questions that nobody's asking. It is about being connected, it's about being authentic, it's about being real. And of course, it is a very, very, very good idea to study the Bible. So don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm just saying we've got to be relevant and we've got to be connected. Okay, so we're going to come into the land. So what's the aftermath of this great moment on the mountain? On days I just close my eyes and I just try to get into some of these stories because it helps me. Because I know that God's called me to be a storyteller and I've got to live in the story. And I just get, sometimes I try to get to this mountain. I mean, what a thing to be a part of. What a moment. To see this profound need met firsthand. Jesus breaks the bread and it just keeps going. Limitless to stop. There could have been a million people there and still would never stop. Because the gates of heaven are being opened and it's being poured through into the earth. It's incredible. And surely that is enough to set you up for life. If you'd have seen that, I have a friend, Don Double, who's an evangelist in his 80s now, and he's been a friend and a support to me for a long time. And he is an amazing ministry. And I said to him, Don, how come you have such a heart and a passion for miracles? And he said, well, I was 16, I was in Africa, and I was with another evangelist, and he said, and he asked me to share my testimony in front of a packed crowd in this kind of ramshackle stadium. And he said, and I started to speak, and this guy came out who had a severely disabled arm. And he stood in front of me and he said, if God is real, demonstrate it. And he said, I was petrified. He said, I felt the presence of 10,000 pairs of eyes on me. And he said, I simply said, in the name of Jesus, be healed. And he said, I watched that man's arm straight in front of me. He said, I can't deny it. So, I hear stories like that, and it's never happened to me. And I read these stories and I'm thinking, surely, for these disciples, that's the clincher. Surely, now. Well, apparently not. It wasn't very long before Jesus had to reinforce the values of this upside-down kingdom to these fellas who had actually seen it happen. Let's have a look. Still in John 6, okay? Verse 60, this is a hard teaching. Not going very well, is it? Verse 66, people deserted him. Verse 67, do you want to leave too? Now this isn't great, is it? I mean, this isn't great success in the training plan. So how long did it take for these boys to be back on the winch? 44 verses of one chapter of John's Gospel. I don't know how long that is. What do you think? I don't know, a week? 3 hours? It's not long. 44 verses. Let's face it, none of these guys is going to win the Disciple of the Month competition, are they? They're not brilliant at what they're supposed to be good at. So maybe there's hope for all of us. Maybe we can all get there. Maybe it's more possible that we could live this way than we've thought. So I've been a Christian since I was 20, and I've been doing this full time since I was 22. So 28 years. I'm 50 now. And you know, like many of you sitting here, you've been around the block a few times, like I have. And like you as well, you know, I'm not in this because I get a warm feeling in my heart during the worship. I'm in this because I know it's the truth. That's why I'm in it. That's why I'm committed. That's why I'm still pushing on. And I just feel ahead of this kind of project that we're involved in. You know, I think we desperately need God. We need him to help us. I need him to help me to do what we're going to be doing. We're all volunteering. We're all signing up for stuff. We'll be doing different things to each other, all of us. But we're all caught up in this great dream that, you know, Easter can be dramatically shaken by the power of the gospel, aren't we? That's why we're in it. That's why we're doing it. It's not just about our church here. I've been in two churches today. Different history, different culture, different legacy, different views about certain areas of the Bible, Holy Spirit, styles of worship. Who cares? It takes all sorts, doesn't it? Some people are going to come here, for sure. Some people will come here and they go, I'll just try down the road. And they'll stay there. But in the end, it's just it's one thing, isn't it? God doesn't carve it up like we like to carve it up. So I think there is a dream in your heart and in my heart that God will do something very powerful over these coming weeks. And I really, really, really want you to come to this event. That's me. Look, I'm better looking in the flesh, aren't I? So we're going to be doing an event here. On the Wednesday the 15th, so four evenings called The Big Story, and we're going to tell the story in here, and we're going to customise it a bit, make it kind of all, I haven't told you this job, we're going to paint it, no we're not, a few banners and a few things, and we're just going to go for it. We're just going to present the gospel and give people a chance to respond, and of course Saturday Night Live is where Paul Quinn's that I'll be hosting, and there'll be a bit of a link with that, so let's pray. In fact, can we all stand if we're able to? That would be wonderful. And I just want to pray for you as a church, for you as individuals. And Father, I thank you so much for this incredible news that we call the gospel. Lord, this message that was born in the heart of the supernatural, Father, for a lost people separated from you, God, through their own stupidity and foolishness through the things that have been done to them. And Father, I pray, Lord, for this church that is called EC Baptist Church. Father, I pray that it would be, that a fresh wind would blow through this place, Lord, and its people. And something of what we have prayed for years we will begin to live in. Something of what is being spoken of this church will come to pass. And as we partner with each other across this town, as we join hands in the gospel, as we make new friends with people that we belong to as family, Lord, I ask you that you would do something wonderful, beautiful, God, in this town throughout the summer. And Lord, I pray my heart cry today, Lord, is that something of what we have spoken of in the security of this building today would mean something to people who live 100 metres from this place, who know nothing but despair. God, we can only guess at what goes on behind the front doors of the houses of these rows. We can only guess. But you see it all, God. I pray that you would get us ready to be relevant, to be compassionate, to be powerful in the way that we provide, to be flexible, and to be trained and mentored by the great shepherd himself. In Jesus' name.